This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Manchester City's 28th visit to the new Wembley proved to be yet another successful one on Sunday. So after that 2-0 win against Nottingham Forest, it means there'll now be a 29th trip to the National Stadium coming up in a couple of weeks' time. And yes, I know it'll actually be the 31st visit, but I wasn't counting the two away games at Spurs, and I was trying not to get bogged down in the details for the introduction. Anyway, welcome to today's Blue Moon Podcast, landing a day earlier in your feeds because of a pesky Friday night game with Wolves. We'll be discussing that win over Forest and the challenge to come from Vitor Pereira's informed side shortly, plus we'll hear from Dave Azzopardi from Talking Wolves as well. We're also going to spend some time focusing on City's left-backs this week, with Nico O'Reilly proving to be the latest in a long line of players who have done well there, despite it not being their natural position. We'll hear Guardiola's thoughts and discuss the situation a little bit more later on. To do all of that, I'm going to need some help. I'm David Mooney. I am joined this week by One Football's Dan Burke.
Hello, David.
And from the Manchester Evening News, we've got Simon Bakowski.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Simon, finally we've been able to sync diaries and get you on this season.
I thought you were never going to ask again.
Apart from every week here. Ever.
Yes. Unhelpfully for the podcast, I have Thursdays off to look after my children, so I usually have to put them above the podcast.
Yeah, all it took was a Friday night game, eh? There we are. Dan, you good?
Very well, thanks, yeah.
Good to hear. I thought we would start this week's, because we started last week's after Matthijs Nunes' winner against Villa with favourite last-minute goals. And given Rico Lewis scored inside 2 minutes at Wembley, I thought we'd have favourite first-minute-ish goals. So, Dan, any particular standouts for you?
I guess the Ilkay Gundogan in the FA Cup final sort of goes without saying, doesn't it, really?
That's kind of the trump card, isn't it?
Yeah. I thought I'd get that one in early, which is also what he did, actually, isn't it? So, yeah. Yeah, that was a good goal. I was also thinking Phil Foden against West Ham on the last day last season. That was a great nerve settler. I think it was 70 seconds or something like that. You know, really sort of got City the perfect start to the game, wasn't it, really? Mm. Outside of that, I'm struggling to really remember that many. You might have to jog my memory a bit here. I remember Giovanni scoring one against Wigan years ago, which I think was sort of inside the first minute. Do you remember that in the Sven season?
Yeah, it was probably about 20 seconds in. They kicked off and he nicked it from the keeper, before the keeper, didn't he?
Yeah, it was like a bad short back pass and he ran onto it and scored and rounded the keeper. But yeah, I'm having difficulty remembering too many of them, to be honest.
There's two that stand out for me. Simon, I'm going to, I know you're not a City fan, so I know you're not bathed in the lore like we are, but any that you remember?
So, I mean, the Foden one against West Ham was good from a sort of, we're in the press box, will City win the title? Yes, of course they will. The one that I enjoyed for sort of the fun of it all was Jesus Navas against Spurs 2013. Navas chipping over Lloris after like 10 seconds and City winning 6-0 was just like the unfiltered madness of Pellegrini's goal machine, really, that season.
Yeah, that goal, like, it really annoys me a little bit that, because for a long time I thought he held the record for the longest time between two goals in a Premier League game because of that. He scored in the 90th minute as well in that game.
Right.
So like 90 minutes between your goals, I'm like, oh, it must be. But apparently Ali Adier for Arsenal had done it like a couple of years earlier, like scored in like the 94th minute and the first minute. So he never held the record, but it'd have been a nice one to hold. The other one I was thinking of, Dan, was Stephen Ireland against Hamburg. That was about as good as that tie got.
Was that a really early one? I don't remember that, actually.
He scored in the first minute away at Hamburg, and I think Robinho sweeps it the length of the field and he ran onto it.
That's right, yeah. I do remember that now. Also, actually, one just came to mind was Julian Alvarez in the Club World Cup final, which is the fastest goal in Club World Cup history, I learned this week. So,
wow. You
know, don't say that we're a club with no history ever again.
Excellent. If we've missed any early goals that you'd like to get a mention to, get in touch, contact at bloomingpodcast.com. You can find us at Blooming Podcast on all the socials as well. Let's talk about Nottingham Forest then. Simon, after weeks of Guardiola perfecting this system of getting all the old-timers in the middle, he didn't pick any of them. So when that team sheet dropped, were you as surprised as anyone?
Well, he picked a few of them. There was Kovacic and Silva in there. I was surprised that he dropped Gundogan. And, you know, obviously De Bruyne not being in there was Yeah, basically, yes. Yes is the short answer. I was like, I'd sort of, you know, reconciled to the fact that, yeah, he's just going to pick all the 30 pluses again because it's working. And then suddenly, here's Rico Lewis, who hasn't played in midfield since they lost 4-0 at home to Spurs in what must, you know, did at the time, but what must in hindsight go down as one of the most abysmal results of the Guardiola era, along with losing to United this season. It was just like, yeah, right, okay. Pep's just going to surprise everyone all the time. And
how have we not learnt by now? 8 years in, how have we not learnt by now?
But this is what we've lost this season. People have sort of, you know, it felt like Guardiola had kind of lost that ability to surprise you in a nice way with his team selections, but it's back, first with the Golden Oldies and now with Rico Lewis.
Yeah. Rico, I mean, we'll come to Rico in more depth later on, Dan, but chucking him in there, having Kovacic and Bernardo in the centre, this kind of 4-2-2-2 system that doesn't really have a striker but kind of does have like attacking midfielders inside, it's given City a lot more stability. So, like, even with the personnel that he'd picked, he still have that air of confidence knowing that they were a lot more stable than they were the last time they played Forest.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, when I saw the team sheet, I had no idea how it was going to shake out. I really couldn't figure it out in my mind what the plan was there, whether he was then going to put Nunes in midfield maybe and put Rico at right back or something. You know, and we saw how it was, and I think Grealish being central was quite key to that as well, which was something that he did in the Nottingham Forest win at home earlier in the season as well, and it was nice to see that kind of...
Grealish started out of nowhere as well.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's like, sometimes you just wonder if he just picks the team by throwing darts at a dartboard or something and see what comes out, or just something like, you know, just random team sheet generator. But it's like, it worked on the day, and it's nice to know that they can kind of deploy that again, because I think... A key feature to this run of form that City are on at the moment is the fact that they've been quite boring in a way. Like, you know, they've sort of like had this control of games. They've done the 1,000 million passes, you know, they've really sort of suffocated possession and really controlled games like that. And earlier in the season, we weren't doing that. You know, we were getting overrun in midfield. The defensive line was getting breached too often. Teams were getting in behind us. And we were having these really like, end-to-end exciting games, but they weren't good for City because we weren't getting the results. And I think, you know, they've looked at the games that we need to win towards the end of the season, and, you know, and especially cup games, and thought, let's kind of grind these results out a little bit. And, you know, I think they've done a very good job, and I think this sort of team selection of packing the midfield a little bit has been key to that. But I can see why it's not part of the long-term vision, really, but it's good to know that they can fall back on that and just make a game a bit dull if they have to.
Yeah, I've just put, I've just done a random team sheet generator for the Wolves game. I've asked an AI to just name the starting 11 for this game. You'll be pleased to know we know now it'll be Edison in goal, Kyle Walker for some reason at right back, Ruben Dias, Josko Gvardiol, Nathan Ake at left back, who knew he was fit, Rodri will play holding midfield so that everything's fine, don't worry about that, Kovacic back in, Phil Foden, Bernardo Silva, Jeremy Doku and Erling Haaland's back, so there you are.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, that's great.
Nice. I mean, I did think with if he keeps doing this with the veterans and then Lewis, and then, you know, if he keeps these surprises up and they keep working, then we might see like a Claudio Bravo clean sheet in the cup final.
Yeah, let's not go mad. Simon, were City lucky in this game?
No.
Because they had chances to kill it off, but Forrest did hit the post three times.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because I sort of had my head down writing the match report in the final sort of 20 minutes or so. But like, it never really felt like Forest were in the game watching it and being there. Sort of Forest, they were battered for the first half, and then Elanga comes on and they show a sign of life. And then within 2 minutes, Guardiola scores and it's kind of game over. City were lucky in the sense that the ball, you know, multiple efforts from Gibbs White hit the post rather than going in or hit the bar. But, you know, if you want to get technical about it, it's not that much luck as skill, I suppose. Unfortunate for Gibbs White, but I never felt like, oh, City are hanging on here or Forest are going to come back and equalise. Thought they might get a goal back, probably should have got a goal back, but again, when Gibbs-White kind of rounds the keeper and Guardiola gives it away and then hits the post, is unlucky, but like, should he have scored? Probably. So, yeah, I don't think Forest can walk away from that. I think they were kind of hard done to by the result. It's a bit like, for anyone who saw it, kind of like the Eubank-Ben fight, in that sort of Ben had plenty of stuff where he was good, but I don't think anyone could ever say that Eubank didn't deserve to win.
I don't really understand boxing and I didn't really see it. So I don't know. I can't really imagine it.
I'm expanding your audience.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of people listening who will get that reference, but I'm just, that's why you got a blank face staring back at you then.
Pep said, didn't he? I think that was a sort of key kind of analytical point. Not a very scientific one, but he said earlier in the season, those chances would have gone in.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case. Like, you know, that doesn't mean that City were lucky on the day. It doesn't mean that they've been unlucky in the past necessarily. It's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes, I think. And earlier in the season, we weren't getting those kind of breaks that we are at the moment. And that's just how your sort of luck works sometimes, I think.
Yeah. The one, I mean, Ali McCoist on the TV, Dan, was saying that Morgan Gibbs-White deserved a goal when he hit the bar with that volley. And I kind of struggle. I understand the point he's making, but I kind of struggle with it because it didn't go in. So, yeah. Like, you don't deserve a goal. It didn't go in.
Well, it's like that Leighton Orient lad getting the goal of the century earlier in the season that hit the bar, didn't it? And, you know, was technically an own goal. So, yeah, people... think about these things in strange terms sometimes.
Yeah. The one thing I do, the one I was concerned about, because the Gibbs-White one, I mean, it's a great hit. City have made it as hard as they possibly can for him to hit that, and he's hit the bar. The one where Awoniyi flicks it onto the post, that again, it's a reaction. You can't, not a lot you can do about that. The one that concerned me was when Gibbs-White hit the post rounding Ortega, because it felt like for that 5-6 minutes, Dan, that City had started to go, we're 2-0 up, we're not really playing with the intention to play anymore, we're just playing with the intention of keeping the ball. And suddenly, you know, Guardiola had no options, and then Gibbs-White gets in. And like that, it kind of felt like City brought that one on themselves.
Yeah, I think in the first half as well, there was a period about 15 minutes towards the end of the first half. I mean, the first 30 minutes were absolutely superb, and if anything, you think... you need to capitalise on that a little bit better, lads. You know, we need to be 2 or 3 goals up from that kind of possession. And I think what's been a little bit of a problem with City recently, and especially with this kind of formation, is it's not hugely creative. They're not creating a lot of chances. They're controlling games, having a lot of the ball, doing a lot of passes. It's very stable, but they're not creating a great deal of chances and not scoring a huge amount of goals at the moment either, which is something we'd like to see a bit more from them from. And it was kind of, you know, a similar situation in the second half. Like you said, they go 2-0 up. The game starts to drift a little bit, and then Forest are allowed to come back into it. And, you know, let's be honest, Forest are a very good side. They have been this season anyway. You know, they're in the top three at the moment. They've, well, maybe not on paper at the moment, but, you know, they're in the conversation for top four, absolutely. And teams like that are going to create chances against you. You know, there was that Alanga one right at the start of the second half as well, which was a bit of a let-off from City's point of view. And yeah, that was a mistake from Guardiola as well. You know, he's had a really good few weeks. I thought he was absolutely excellent in this game, apart from that, and obviously scoring the goal. But he makes that mistake, nearly lets them back in, and that could have, the game could have changed on that, really. So I think they need to cut out these moments of sort of like lack of concentration, whatever you want to call it, taking their eye off the ball. And I think we've seen that a lot this season, where even the best performances, we've seen sort of like 75% of a good performance or 80% of a good performance. There's been bits missing from every single game, really, which is
that's why you get the season that they've had, though, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. They need to improve on that next season if they're going to get back to the top, basically. But the sort of encouraging signs are there, I think.
Yeah, let's talk about the positives then, Simon, because Rico Lewis, we've talked about him being shocked that he was starting in the midfield. Obviously, Guardiola didn't put him in there to score, but it's nice for him to get into that shooting position so early and to pop it in the bottom corner.
Yeah, and what a knee slide, can I just say. It was he's one that sort of fantastic in real time, even better in slow motion. Fair play to the lad. Yeah, brilliant. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because he is a lot of things, there's been a lot of potential at City this season that has been wasted or gone badly wrong. And it feels like kind of like James McAtee always plays better in a team that is playing well. And I can kind of understand why Guardiola wouldn't want to throw him into a team that was flunking every possible test. And Lewis is another who started off the season brilliantly and then played and played and played and got played into the floor, and his confidence went into the floor. And he started off wanting to play, well, wants to play as an eight in midfield. And, you know, there was that time he earlier on in the season, feels like a lifetime ago, when, you know, he was picked in midfield for Lee Carsley's England team and felt like he was the future of club and country. And then the season has unraveled in front of him. But it feels like now City are a bit more stable and a bit more kind of consistent and not boring, but, you know, controlling games a bit more. It's allowing these things that could have happened to maybe happen again. And Lewis in midfield is one of them. And yeah, whether the box midfield is here to stay, who knows? But it allowed Lewis and others on Sunday to really enjoy themselves playing. And you get a lot of fight and a lot of grit with Lewis, but we also saw a lot of creativity from him and him kind of like driving things on in the middle, and trying to find the space in tight spaces like he got when he scored. So yeah, really, a really positive, day for him and for Pep, really. Mm.
Is this the end of him at right back then?
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, sort of going into the season and obviously his performances over the last couple of seasons, I couldn't speak highly enough of Rico Lewis. I absolutely loved him. You know, I thought he was a fantastic player and had pretty much been fantastic every time he steps on the pitch for City. And I think he started the season quite well. And the amount of games that he's played this season, he's played 41 games so far this season, nearly 3,000 minutes. And I think if you told him at the start of the season he was going to do that, he'd be delighted with that. But in a way, I think it's been a bit detrimental to him that he's played a little bit too much. He's been a bit overexposed. He's had to grow up a little bit too quickly almost this season and been over-relied on at times, and has had a period out of the team now, you know, which I think was fair enough, really, because I don't think he was playing particularly well. I think he was, you know, struggling with the physicality of games sometimes as well. So it was good to see him coming into a game where there wasn't as much defensive responsibility required from him. He was able to express himself a little bit more. You know, he took the goal superbly well, and I think his general play was really good in the game. Now, would I like to see him going back to right back? Probably not long term, really, because I think that's an area they really, really need to address in the summer. I don't think he's the long-term answer to that. And the question is he the long-term answer anywhere else either, really? You know, it's like, is he actually good enough to really stake a claim for himself in this team? He's still only 20. He's got plenty of time on his side. I love the idea of having him around as a squad player for a long, long time. But I don't know what the future holds for Rico Lewis really at the moment, more than being a kind of bit part utility player in the future in a team that's successful anyway. You know, you wouldn't really expect to see him playing very much, really, which is a bit of a shame. But we'll see.
Yeah, I was going to say this, Simon. If he isn't a right back anymore and he is picked as that kind of eight player, if City then go and address the problems that they've had in midfield in the summer, like that just is a blockage to Lewis, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's a problem that kind of Foden has had, whereby he's good in different positions, so doesn't necessarily get played in his preferred position. I think, I mean, one thing in Lewis's favour is that he will be fit to play three games a week. And if you're looking along the defenders, I'm not sure how many of them are. You know, I think he will play games at right back in future just because he'll have to. Like, Walker's going, even if they bring someone in, like, there's still a vacuum and a vacancy there. But it will be interesting because, yeah, if they sign the midfield players that they want to sign, then I can't see any room for him in that midfield. So his chances are going to have to come from right back. But then you look and, like, at the start of the season, he was brilliant at right back before it all started to go wrong. So it's, you know, I think he's got the talent to stay in the squad, but it's just where, you know, how happy he is fighting for minutes and where he wants to play and things like that.
Yeah, we'll come to more on that a bit later on with somebody else. But first, Dan, great to finally get a goal from a set piece as well, because it feels like City are absolutely shocking at them. I genuinely think, I can only think of John Stones scoring against Arsenal and Wolves earlier this season that they've actually bagged from a corner.
Yeah, I mean, Gvardiol's been a pretty reliable source of goals from set pieces, but hasn't really done an awful lot this season prior to this game either. You know, Diaz hasn't scored for bloody ages. Like, it must be a couple of seasons since Diaz's last goal.
How can you be so good in the air defensively and so bad in the air offensively? It doesn't make sense, does it?
Yeah. He had a chance against Villa, didn't he, the other week, where he sort of, it was more a sort of volleyed chance and he kind of scuffed it and it was blocked. And you think, come on, Ruben, just take that. You know, Haaland isn't the most dangerous threat from set pieces either, you know, and isn't fantastic in the air. So that is a problem. You know, we're not going to have De Bruyne last season, who's been a decent deliverer of corners and free kicks. So, you know, I think Marmoush took this one, didn't he? And it was, you know, he's pretty good at them as well. But yeah, I'd like to see us doing a bit more, being a bit more creative with them. You know, stuff like that goal Liverpool scored against us this season, that kind of innovative free kick. You can't do that every game, obviously. There's only so many sort of chances to do that. But I'd like to see us just trying something a little bit different with them sometimes. Does City have a set piece coach, actually?
Carlos Vicens takes care of them.
Yeah, I hope he's not being paid per goal, because he'll be on the breadline, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, it should be noted that, you know, traditionally the people who score you goals from corners are your biggest players and your centre-backs, and all of City's centre-backs have been injured.
Crocs.
Erling Haaland's probably the biggest player and he's probably the worst player in the air in the squad. So, yeah.
This will be the first and last time that my father is ever compared to Erling Haaland. but my dad always used to say, because he was a tall kid and he played centre-back, he had to relearn how to jump to head the ball, because when he was younger, he was taller than everybody else. He could just head it before they did. And then I just wonder if Haaland has the same sort of thing. He never had to really work to head it because he was bigger than everybody. And now everybody's caught up. He can't do it.
I mean, I'm 6'6" and I'm shit in the air as well. But also shit on the ground. So it sort of balances itself out.
Yeah. Caught me old-fashioned, Simon, as well, but in the build-up, I missed that goal entirely, because in the build-up to it, I was apoplectic that City hadn't been given a penalty. caught me old-fashioned, but if the ball hits your arm as it's on the way in, it probably should be a spot kick.
You were furiously rewinding.
Yeah.
I thought it should have been a penalty. I could sort of see the argument for his arms were in a natural position. I did feel like his arm flicked up to make sure it hit his hand, which for me is kind of the sign of a penalty. but also just sort of, I thought it was really positive play from City that meant that sort of they made that move, because that was just minutes after Elanga had that chance. And it was just kind of like an opportunity of kind of City taking control of the match and control of the, you know, earning their luck basically. And then also having not had the penalty, to then just sort of say, all right, well, we're just going to score from a corner then instead. See you later.
Yeah, they'd have probably missed from the spot anyway, wouldn't they, John?
Probably, yeah. Who would have taken a penalty on that pitch, actually? Because it's sort of Haaland and De Bruyne, isn't it? And neither of them were playing. So,
can I volunteer Matthias Nunes after he's won in the Community Shield?
Oh, yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd want to take it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether it be allowed.
it was that Guardiola one at Fulham, wasn't it? Last season when he was on two and City got a penalty. He was like, no, I don't want this. He already knew what Guardiola was going to say if he took it and missed it. So he didn't want it.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Get a dollop of City nostalgia every Monday. Sign up at patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
Let's talk about the defenders and the fullbacks more specifically. Left-backs are not something that City seems to have in any normal sense these days. During Pep Guardiola's time at the club, there have been a number of players who have impressed in that role, despite their natural position being somewhere else on the pitch. Nico O'Reilly is the latest to be moulded into a left-sided defender. I've been looking at his rise and how Guardiola has used his predecessors. Pep Guardiola has tinkered with the fullbacks at City ever since his first season. It proved a little difficult at the time with the profile of the squad back then. Gael Clichy, Pablo Zabaleta and Bakary Sagna were all, in the politest possible way, getting on a bit, and they struggled to do what was needed of them when they moved into midfield. However, when the new signing Benjamin Mendy was injured at the beginning of the next season, Guardiola needed a longer-term solution. It came in the shape of midfielder Fabian Delph.
Always a little bit of mystery in the terms against Shakhtar, played the first time, but playing against West Bromwich Albion, but in Shakhtar, in important game in Champions League, and he was outstanding. And today again, and even with our process to build up, like he's a midfield player, when he receives the ball, he doesn't lose one ball. He knows when you play in front, back, to the other side. Oh, he played really good. I'm so happy for him.
That was Guardiola speaking after City had beaten Chelsea 1-0 at Stamford Bridge in 2017. It was only the third time the manager had played Delph at left-back, and he was drifting into the centre of midfield to help with City's build-up.
It's not easy when for a long period you don't play, and okay, the manager gives you the opportunity and play one position when never you played before. In Champions League and here. So, it means a lot.
Has he trained Rich in this new position kind of earlier in the season before playing?
Yeah, sometimes when we make a training session or games, always we use him here, there, yeah. And we go there close to him and said, okay, in that situation, some drills a little bit to be comfortable. And after with the ball, he's a bit wide inside, and be, like his midfield player has the quality. No, it's not as scary to play, but sometimes in the pressure, put the ball, he try always to play, so... And give us to give extra pass, an extra pass, an extra pass. Let the opponent run. And help us a lot to have this kind of players.
Delph would play the majority of that season in that role before losing his place the following Christmas. Silly red cards against Wigan and Leicester put a blot on his copybook, while conceding a daft penalty in an FA Cup tie at Swansea didn't help either. But another big factor was the emergence of Alexander Zinchenko in his position.
Alex is another player who is so reliable. So Alex always will be... I will never forget what he has done these 3 or 4 years playing a position that he's in a natural position. And when you don't play a natural position, you can play one game, two games. But playing seasons, when he's not in another position, you have to be so strong in your head, in your mind.
That was Guardiola after City had beaten Watford 5-1 at the Etihad in 2022. By this stage, Zinchenko had been playing out of position at left-back for just over 3 years, and while he could come inside, he was also used to provide width in a way that Delph wasn't. That was perhaps most noticeable when he came off the bench to give better balance to the team when they were trying to turn around a deficit to Aston Villa on the final day of that season. After that Watford performance, Guardiola explained why he'd adapted so well.
For the needs that we have, that we don't have left-back for many years and whatever, so... He adapted and said, okay, what do you need the team? I'm going to do it. And that's why. It's a reliable player, honestly. And sometimes when lately play less or it was not performed like normal, because we have to understand they are human beings. What happened in his country, we cannot forget it. And so that's why sometimes, okay, but I know Alex. He doesn't play that the way he played today to know exactly who Alex is for us or for me or for the team. Is not necessary.
But as much as Zinchenko had edged out Delph in the makeshift left-back stakes, he was also finding that he was sharing that position with another player who was also out of position. City had brought João Cancelo as a right-back, but they saw his best performances on the opposite side. In 2021, after City had beaten Borussia Mönchengladbach, Guardiola explained how he used his left-back to TNT Sports.
We come from Germany, that they won't lose a ball, they kill you in the counter-attack when our fullbacks were wider. So this is one of the reasons why I learned this. In Barcelona, I have more controls in the game with the incredible players that we have, and they need 3 guns and 100 bullets to lose one ball. And it was not impossible to lose them both. In Germany, it was completely different, and they run. But the main reason is to have more players in the middle to pass the ball. This is the main reason.
Cancelo really shone during the lockdown season as City reclaimed the title from Liverpool. He would often roam around the centre of the field, more like a number 10, and he gave City more control of games.
We have control maybe when you lose it, but the main reason is have more players, 4, 5, 6 players, to make a short passes and more control. This is the only reason why. Everyone, we did it with Fabian Delph to the year with 100 points. It was incredible, with Alex Zinchenko as well. And Joao had this quality to do it. Of course, not all the fullbacks can play in this position. Last game against Fulham, for example, we play with Mendy, and Mendy is a guy who has to play in the sides, depending on the skills. We adapt the quality of the players and the way we want to play. But in the big concept is
is we defend with the ball. We have to have the ball as much as possible and be aggressive when we don't have it, be incredible aggressive everyone, and with the ball a lot of passes and passes and passes.
But then in 2023, City found they had to fix that problem again. They'd sold Zinchenko to Arsenal, and Cancelo was moved out on loan after falling out with the manager. For the remainder of that treble-winning season, centre-backs Nathan Ake and Manuel Akanji stepped in. The role was that of a more traditional style left-back at that time, but that would change once again with the new signing, Josko Gvardiol.
We cannot forget, come to Premier League for season, he's 21 years old, so it's not, I would say it's not easy to handle it and the beginning struggle a little bit. Oh, come a team like won the treble and I don't want to be, was a little bit shy, a little bit, oh, I don't want to ruin all the structure that they have, what happened. It's a question of time, but he then come here for a few months, come for many, many years to come, and he's proving himself he can do it and play with us.
That was what Guardiola said about Gvardiol after the 4-0 win at Fulham last season. The defender, naturally a centre-back, scored twice, having played most of the season on the left-hand side of defence. It completed a run of 5 goals in 7 games, but the manager was more impressed with how the Croatian was helping City in the build-up. And it's similar to what he said when I asked this week about what Nico O'Reilly was doing to make the team more stable.
Physically, his presence, like his attacking midfielder, his composure with the ball. Surprised how is it defensively, how attention he is. He has a pace. Give us an extra play in set pieces that help us because we are weak in that position. And yeah, his generosity to play in the position like he's not used to and giving everything for the team. So in the back four now we are stable. So we have pace with Josko, with Mateus and Nico because they are so fast, and the intelligence and leadership, unbelievable leadership from Ruben. So mainly that is the reason why.
With a few FA Cup goals and his strike to open the scoring at Everton under his belt, O'Reilly is, like Gvardiol, a big goal threat from left back as well.
It's a movement for a striker that I would love to do, my strikers to do the movement. Always I said, to win a score of the goals, finish in front of the keeper, in front, and you will score goals. And he did it. And now he adapted in a position that not used. So, and we can open with him. Now we play Jeremy, we can open with Jeremy, and he play a position attacking midfielder like Fabian Delph, Alex or Joao, or many, many fullbacks play in that position. So the ductility, it helped us a lot. That's why Nico in that case deserves the minutes now he's playing, because he's given us a lot of things.
Guardiola joked after the FA Cup tie with Bournemouth that O'Reilly would play in the semi-final after his introduction at half-time changed that game. But it's gone from a joke to O'Reilly starting every match since, just because of how stable the defence has become with him in it. He's not looked like he's playing out of position, but in reality, he's the latest in a long line of players that Guardiola has fitted into the team with a tweak to the left-back role.
This is Willie Donicky, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. Enjoy.
The Blue Moon Podcast. If City won't let you down on the pitch, let us let you down off it instead.
The one name I forgot to chuck in there, Dan, was Sergio Gomez. But, you know, there are so many players that City have... so many attacking midfielders that City have played at left-back. It's like we're losing count of them now. Nico O'Reilly's been good, hasn't he? He's been really helping in the last few weeks.
Yeah, how could you forget Sergio Gomez, by the way? That's such a memorable time at the club. Like, I'll never forget that man. Yeah, O'Reilly has been absolutely superb, you know, for a player playing out of position. I mean... The sort of way that the fullbacks have been used, especially in that left-back position over the years with like Delph and Zinchenko, and you know the way that City play caters to a technically good player playing in that position. You don't necessarily have to be a sort of traditional defender to play left-back for City, or you haven't had to in recent years. You know, I'd still like them to address that and bring an actual left-back in at some point, like, you know, a specialist at some point. But, you know, I think the team is built around making it not easy, but, like, you know, if you've got good on the ball, good awareness, you can play in that position. And that's exactly what O'Reilly's got. I can't think of any situations really where he's been caught out or been skinned when he's played there. You know, I think that's a criticism you could level at Mateus Nunes on the other side, who I think has done really well for the most part this season, but a couple of times has been caught a bit cold and I'd play just skip past him a bit too easily. You know, Riley's physicality, he's a big lad. He can hold players off. He can, you know, put a tackle in as well. So I think he's got all the attributes to play there. I wouldn't like to see that be his future, because I think it's sort of wasting him a little bit there. But in this team at the moment, he's done a solid job. And I think his performances have been a big part of City's form. And especially going forward as well, you know, he can really help like move play up the pitch, get into those wide positions, pin the opposition fullback back and give them something to think about. Yeah, I think he's been absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, Simon, it's not a coincidence, is it, that since he's come into the team, I mean, first off, it started off with that sub at Bournemouth where he basically fixed all the problems that City had at Bournemouth and the game turned around. But from then on in, it's been 1-5, drawn 1, lost none. And that like that can't be a coincidence, can it?
No, and Bournemouth was also kind of the start of the mad selections, really, because at half-time, they're 1-0 down. They've had chances, but Bournemouth have been the better side. And he takes off Kusunov, who's been sort of the best defender for the last few weeks, and puts O'Reilly on, who, you know, few have heard of. And people are thinking, how on earth is this going to make you turn around an FA Cup game at a really good side? And then within a few minutes, he's come up with the assist. And yeah, I mean, I've known about Nico O'Reilly for years, and for years he's been seen as one of the most talented players in the academy. And I know people who, you know, would champion him and say, oh yeah, he can do this, he can do that, he can do that. Nobody, absolutely nobody would have thought he could come into this side and play left back and have the impact he can have. It's been incredible. It's been one of the stories of the season for me. Like, I just stopped and watched him against Villa and was just like, what a player. And the same at Wembley against Forest. I don't know whether it's a purple patch or something that he will have for his whole career, but he looks so languid when he sort of runs and decides to do things. But every decision he makes, every duel, every 50-50, he wins, he comes out with the ball. That bit in the first half against Forest when he sort of spins round one player, spins round another, and then...
He had to shoot after that. You can't do that and then not shoot, can you?
Yeah, but it's just... remarkable, and it's almost like a good luck charm with him in the team. They just play well and win because he never loses the ball. You know, he has been targeted defensively. Palace had some joy against him, but I think that side with Guardiola, because Guardiola's played the position, but Guardiola is also more comfortable as a centre back, so he kind of can. He's almost perfect to know the spaces where the left back should be, but where the left back might not be because they've gone upfield. It is just working like a dream. Like the Guardiola O'Reilly partnership is almost better than the Guardiola Diaz partnership, I'd say.
There is a like with Rico Lewis, Dan, there is another question about this, because obviously this isn't his position. This is where he's filling in. We would expect City again. There's so much to address in the summer, but left back is one of those situations where, I mean, they haven't addressed it in the past, but this may be the summer that they go and do that. If they do that, does he have the same problem as Rico Lewis? Does he not fit into the team elsewhere because there's more senior players in those positions?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, the academy's been a great money spinner for City over the years. You know, we've had really good players coming through, talented players, and the sort of philosophy has been, we'll try and give you some minutes. If you're not happy with the minutes you're getting, we'll sell you on for decent money, and maybe we'll put a buyback clause in, and maybe we'll consider bringing you back in the future. I think maybe the Cole Palmer situation has made them rethink that a little bit, and especially when it comes to a player like Nico O'Reilly, like they've got to be careful about kind of keeping this guy happy and keeping him around, because he's a gem. He's one of those players that doesn't come along every day. I think he's better than Rico Lewis. He's more talented than him, and I do really like Rico Lewis. But I think City have got to make sure that there's a future for O'Reilly. There is a sort of like guaranteed amount of minutes that he's going to get, and he's going to get played in a favoured position at some point. You know, like Simon was saying about Guardiola, I'd love Guardiola to just be a centre-back now, really, I think. I think that suits him a lot better. Even though he's done really well at left-back, I think it makes us better as a team with him there. So maybe there is a future for O'Reilly as a sort of auxiliary left-back, you know, even going into next season, even if they bring someone else in. Maybe there's a future for him a bit further forward as well as a midfielder. You know, De Bruyne's off, Gundogan will be around next season, but you can't imagine he's going to play that much. You know, he's very much over the hill, isn't he? And next season, I would like to see him in sort of almost like a player coaching role, which you would think would potentially free up the chance for O'Reilly to play there. Even if they bring a couple of players in, you know, you'd like to think there'll be opportunities for O'Reilly to play there. There was talk in the summer about him maybe playing as like a defensive midfielder, number six type. That's not been tried once all season, which makes you think they've tried it on the training ground and it didn't go particularly well, or he's not quite at that level yet to kind of play that position. But yeah, they've got to make a space in the squad for O'Riley because he's that good.
Can you put your arm around him, Simon, and just say to him, like, I know you want to play in attacking midfield, but here from left back, the way that City play, you are getting into those positions anyway. So you do have that same sort of influence. It's just that, you know, nominally, as you write the team sheet out, you are a left back.
I mean, not everyone could get their arm around him because he's massive.
And Dan's got a good shot at 6'6".
Yeah, but that is another thing that goes in his favour. You know, he's physical. And when you see him charging from left back, you know, it's a lot of the sort of physicality and aggression and agility that has been missing from the City midfield for much of this season. So,
if he's worried about not being in those positions, like, look where he was when he scored against Everton. He made a near post run. It's like, that's the left back.
Yeah.
He's a left back, remember.
I think, like, as Dan was saying, he's just making, he's shown that he's got the quality to play in the team. Doesn't matter where you pick him, but you have to make space for him in the team and the squad. And, you know, I don't know whether it's a rite of initiation that everyone starts at left back in the Pep Guardiola team. Like, some people have to sing a song or like do a silly dance, but Pep's like, you have to play left back for my team. But you know what a hazing for O'Riley it's been. And I don't see any reason why he couldn't continue at left back as long as he's kind of enjoying it. I think we saw Zinchenko there for quite a number of years, which worked pretty well. As long as you've got the cover, like, but at the same time, you know, I do know that City are interested in signing a left back this summer, and they've had interest in Cambiasso from Juve for a long time. So, you know, it might not work out, but if he can, yeah, it's he has to be in the squad next season, and he has to get, you know, plenty of games because he's making a difference right now.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
Well, let's look ahead now to the game with Wolves. Dan, here's a nice little lovely stat to kick us off with. City have never, ever, ever beaten Wolves on a Friday. Lost 4-1 away in December 99 and then lost 3-2 on Boxing Day in 2019.
Boxing Day doesn't count for me. It's almost like a day in its own right, isn't it? No, you lose track of what the days are over Christmas. So
So it's not officially a Friday, even though it was a Friday.
Not a great omen that, though, is it?
Yeah, but because of COVID, and also like because of the way that things have fallen, because of COVID, Friday will be the first time that fans have been in the Etihad when City haven't been reigning champions or champions elect for that season since the 10th of April 2018, more than 7 years. It feels different, doesn't it?
Yeah, pouring one out for Richard Burns in particular, who loves that stat, doesn't he?
I know.
It's... It is quite weird to see another team, well, they've not actually lifted it yet, have they? But touching our trophy, give it back. It's ours.
Yeah, got to get on for that next season. Wolves, in all seriousness, Wolves have been coming into form, Simon, but so have City. So what do you expect from this?
I feel like City should win. Someone else put it to me that, like, oh, Wolves are in form and Pep's kind of banging the drum for it. And it's like, well, yeah, they are, but they're still kind of like at the wrong end of the table. They are the form team in the Premier League, and things are coming together under Pereira. They've got some very good players. But I feel like, you know, especially playing Friday night, City are playing before anyone else. If they win, they go third. They put the pressure on all of their rivals. And this is what City have been so great at over the years, not just managing games, but like managing situations and title races or Champions League races as it is this season. Like, I know City are not what they have been over the past few years, but we're starting to see the resurgence. And regardless of kind of performance or anything else, City just sort of should know, like, yeah, if we beat Wolves on Friday, it puts us in a super strong position ahead of, you know, the weekend's games, and we'll see what everyone else is made of. So at home as well, I just kind of think they should have too much for them. But I've been proved wrong many times this season.
Not to massively tempt fate either, but have you seen the teams that Wolves have beaten in that six-game run? I mean, United were one of them for a start.
I was going to say, it's the real dregs
of the league, basically, yeah.
I was going to do the same thing. I was going to say exactly that. They've all been the bottom sides, like Southampton, Leicester, Manchester United.
Spurs as well.
Yeah.
God, it literally is the bottom six, isn't it?
Yeah.
That said, though, Dan... You look at the way that City have been controlling games recently, and you talked about it earlier on. It feels like if one of the teams has to change how they have been playing recently to fit for the other, or to have a chance of beating the other, it's Wolves that has to change for what City are going to do. And that kind of gives you confidence that City are the ones in control of this tie, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think Wolves have got good players and have had all season, really, you know, and Pereira's come in and really solidified things and got the good feeling about the place. You know, he's going for beers with the fans and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they've got a good feeling. They'll go into it feeling pretty confident. And, you know, it's a free hit for them, isn't it, really? They've got nothing to lose. They can't go down. They're in a good run. No one's really expecting them to win this one. And they've got players like, you know, Cunha's in great form, who I think could cause us troubles. But I think if City can kind of control the turnovers, you know, control the game in the way that they have been recently, you know, they should get the job done. You know, I'd like to see, you know, maybe a few more sort of pizzazzy, that's not a word, but I'm going to say it anyway, players come in than what we saw at the weekend, like Doku. I'd like to see him start, for example, because I think he's due a start and you know, has had a good impact from the bench recently. I think this is a game for De Bruyne as well, you know, having not played at the weekend, I think he can come in and do something here. And, you know, it should be a good game on a Friday night under the lights. I'm looking forward to it. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing what Wolves can do against us and looking forward to seeing how we repel it and seeing what we can respond with. So, yeah, I fancy a good game here.
Yeah. Would you like to go for a beer with Guardiola? Or do you think he'd be a bit intense on a night out?
I think he'd be very intense, wouldn't he? Yeah, you'd be trying to get home and he'd be there at 4 o'clock in the morning talking you through juego de posición and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, come on, Pep, I've missed the last bus already.
Does personnel matter at this stage, Simon? Because we talked about how all the oldies didn't play against Forest and it still worked just the same. So like if you toss a coin, you get Savinho or Grealish. If you toss a coin, you get Doku. Like, does it matter at this stage who he picks?
No, I think he'll pick a team and everyone will go, what on earth is that team? And then they'll win the game and everyone will be very happy. It matters to individuals, like, you know, Grealish must want to start more than one Premier League game in the calendar year. Phil Foden must want to start, having not started, you know, since the United game, and Doku as well will probably want to be more than a super sub. But it just feels like City are in the groove. And like I asked Pep after the Villa game, because sort of when City went to Villa Park in December, Villa just played their game and battered them. And Villa tried to play their game at the Etihad and they couldn't, because City were sort of imposed their game on them instead. So it does feel like City have kind of regained the authority in games, and it sort of doesn't matter who plays in that sense, because the whole unit is working better together.
Yeah. Quick one on Bernardo as well, Simon, because we haven't really mentioned him. But he's had criticism this season, and I think it's probably fair to say he's not had a good season overall. But you really notice in the last few weeks how well he's been doing just to keep City in possession and to keep the pressure on the other team.
Yeah. He's a tricky one, Bernardo. I don't feel like he's had a bad season, but it's just... He's never stepped up with goals and assists. He's another one that always, when City play well, his contributions are really noticed. And when they play badly, he's another one who you're like, well, why don't they do more? Why doesn't he do more? And I feel for a player who kind of for years has looked like he will run himself into the ground every match. He still looks like that this season, but he's almost looked like he's been running against his will. And, you know, Pep said he was mentally gone by like January because he just kept playing and City kept losing. But he's kept going and so I don't feel like his performances have dipped that much. But now that the team's come back, his contributions are starting to matter more. And I mean, my colleague who spoke to him after the Bournemouth game at the end of March and sort of suggested that everyone was writing off the oldies, and he got very angry and said, give me names. And it was like, well, you. But he keeps insisting that, you know, they're not over the hill and they've got more to give. And you look at his recent performances and you think, well, fair enough.
Yeah. Just checking how old Bernardo Silva is.
30.
To see whether I feel old or not. So I feel very old. Dan, have you been surprised how much Guardiola has leaned on Kovacic for the central role in recent weeks? Like, he's done well, but at the same time, you know, they brought in Nico Gonzalez because they didn't have anybody who could do it. And then since Gonzalez has arrived, they found, oh, Kovacic can do it alongside Bernardo.
Kovacic is another decrepit 30-year-old, isn't he? So, yeah. I mean, I thought he was excellent at the weekend and has been, you know, for a couple of games now, really, yeah. And, you know, he's a player I like when he's in form. He's frustrated me a little bit this season, but he's been a decent source of goals. And I think, you know, he's overall had a pretty good season. I've also really liked what I've seen from Nico Gonzalez, but I wonder if there's a little bit of a, you know, these new players were brought in January with a sort of aim of like freshening things up. And they did that for a few weeks and, you know, with sort of varying degrees of success. And now he's sort of, now the results are coming a bit more easily with kind of the old guard. He's fallen back a little bit on the players that he trusts, that he knows have been, you know, here for a lot longer and kind of understand what is required of them a little bit more. And he's kind of giving players like Nico a bit of a bit part role. You know, the same with Kusunov. He's not played since Bournemouth, has he? You know, he's really fallen back on that Guardiola-Diaz partnership, which doesn't mean, you know, there's a bad future for Kusunov and he doesn't rate him. I think it's just kind of a, let's get to the end of the season with the experienced players. The new lads can kind of learn from them. And then next season, they can kind of like hit the ground running, hopefully. And yeah, Kovacic, you know, I thought he was man of the match by far on Sunday. You know, his some of his passing choices were superb. The way he sort of wriggles away from challenges sometimes and like turns away from stuff and really, you know, is good at keeping the ball. You know, I think he's one of the best players in the world at that on his day. So, yeah, bit of an unfairly maligned player at times, and it's good to see him in good form at the moment. I hope he keeps it up.
Yeah. Let's get a Wolves perspective on things for this one. I've been speaking to Dave Azzopardi from Talking Wolves to find out more about their recent form.
Yeah, good. Like you said, 6 wins on the bounce, 7 matches unbeaten. I mean, you look at the those fixtures, it's actually the 7 teams below us in the Premier League. So you would hope that we were picking points up against those sort of teams. But saying that, Wolves aren't the strongest team in the Premier League. You know, this has matched our best ever top flight winning run as well. So yeah, all good. I mean, 4 or 5 game weeks ago, I was still had slight reservations about our Premier League status for next season. But you know, I think we're 20 points ahead of Ipswich now. It's been a ridiculous run of form. And again, in that time frame, I thought we'd never finish above 17th because we hadn't been above 17th all season. And now we're sat in 13th place. So yeah, the table is looking much, much better than what it was just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, what's changed? Because it's surely not just the manager, is it?
Possibly. I think in terms of playing squad, we had a playing squad there that I think a lot of Wolves fans looked at and probably neutral fans looked at as well and thought, why is this team struggling? You know, you look at some of the individual players that we've got. But I think the manager change, it has had a big impact. I think he's just simplified a lot of things. I think Gary O'Neill is probably good at some elements of coaching, but I think, as a lot of modern coaches are, he was really deep into the analytical side of things and almost trying to overcomplicate things, if I'm completely honest. Whereas I think Vitor's come in and just stripped everything back to basics, getting sort of the players to, firstly, put the effort in, which we weren't quite seeing under Gary O'Neill. And I think that's the main thing. He had been backed in January. There were, you know, players like Emmanuel Agbadou, who's come in at the heart of defence, has been phenomenal. He's brought in a few different players just to strengthen us, you know, depth-wise as well. And look, like I said earlier, that in terms of the fixtures, it was an easier run of fixtures, but it does still include Manchester United and Tottenham, who haven't had great seasons, but you know that they can still cause you problems. And just been a really, really solid run and, you know, getting all the fans on side, and there's finally a bit of a feel-good factor back at Wolves at the moment.
Yeah, what's it like going to Molineux at the minute as well with this sort of run of form? Is it suddenly feel like carefree? All the pressure's kind of gone?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think there are still obviously some reservations. Like, for argument's sake, Saturday I went into that game on a 5-match winning run against relegated Leicester, and I still had reservations on whether we get the job done. And you know, we did do it comfortably in the end. But yeah, the atmosphere is as good as it's been since sort of Nuno departed, really. I mean, Molineux was rocking when we had Nuno, and it's never really found that same sort of atmosphere and bounce under Vitor Pereira. I'm starting to see that and feel that a little bit more. You would have seen, you know, on mainstream media after wins, he's going out to the local pubs and celebrating with fans, which is fantastic. And it's not just a one-off. He's done it pretty much the last 5 or 6 weeks after the wins. So it's good. He's, you know, associating himself with the fans. And I think that's key. And all we've got to hope for now is that the club back in, because the last couple of managers have been sort of ticked off with how they've been backed. Bruno Lage, Lopetegui, Gary O'Neill have all sort of made comments about it. So hopefully it's different for Vitor, and they can start to see the potential and what this team's got.
Yeah, what's he changed kind of on the pitch? Has your setup changed or anything like that?
A little bit, yeah. I think, again, under Gary O'Neill, he couldn't quite find what was the best setup. We saw switches from back fives to back fours. And we know, again, going back to Nuno, it was a back five and Wolves had so much joy with that. Bruno Lage stuck with it in his first season and did relatively well. As soon as he switched to a back four, he really, really struggled. So with Vitor Pereira, has just been the shape from day one. It's been a back five, a middle two, and then a front three. And what's changed really over, probably since the end of January, really, in the start of our good run, is we've brought in a guy called Marshall Manetzi in from France. And footballing wise, technical ability wise, he's not fantastic, if I'm completely honest, but physically he'll run from minute one to minute 95 or 96. And basically he's put him in that sort of number 10 role around Jorgen Strandlarsen and around Matheus Cunha. And he does a lot of the dirty work. So, I mean, there's been stats being thrown about this week. Matheus Cunha's got the highest percentage of walking during a Premier League game. Fair enough, because you know when he's got the ball, he's top quality. But with the introduction of players like Manetzi, who does divide fans, because like I said, he's not a fantastic actual footballer, but his physicality on the pitch has really, really helped us. And then just players coming into form. I mean, the middle two of Andre and João Gomes have been phenomenal. Agbadou, who I mentioned earlier, has really solidified us defensively. But yeah, Manetti's been a big sort of cog and part of that team to just help add a bit more energy to that front line.
Yeah, a couple of players to ask you about there as well. We'll start with Matheus Cunha because he seems to be gathering headlines. But from the outside, all it seems to be is that he just seems to score every game. Is that like? Can you just rely on him for a goal in most games these days?
Saturday against Leicester, it was another goal and two assists. Four matches of our six match winning streak were without Matheus Cunha due to suspension as well. You know, we were really worried about that. You know, it was a complete head loss in the FA Cup, and I think he headbutted Kerkez, and he was sent off. And it wasn't his first defence like that this season, which is what was a concern and really frustrated fans. But we coped to a degree fairly well without him. He's come back in and just been even better, to be completely honest. I'm not a huge fan of his antics off the pitch with his cryptic messaging. He had a little dig at us on social media a couple of weeks ago as well, which was frustrating. But I mean, I can't deny his footballing ability is phenomenal, and it looks like he's going to Manchester United. Do I think that's the right decision? I don't know. But all we can do is hopefully he sticks with us, still gives us 110% between now and the end of the season, and we continue to see the best out of him, because he's got potential to. Right, I think Jimenez has got the most Premier League goals for us in a season with 17. I think Matheus is on 15 or 16. So hopefully he breaks that between now and the end of the campaign.
Yeah, and the other name you mentioned there, Strandlarsen. Mm-hmm. I mean, he feels like he's coming to form as well. He's just looking at his record as well. He's scored a few in the last few games.
Yeah.
He's on loan. Have you got any hopes of keeping him?
Yeah, I think there was an option or obligation to buy that went. It activated itself after a certain amount of appearances. So that's pretty much done. So I think he's about 25 million. And we spoke about him earlier on as well on our podcast because, you're right, he's coming to form at a really good time. I think he scored 5 in 5. Missed a great chance on Saturday and didn't dwell on it because within a couple of minutes he put the ball in the back of the net. So I'm really excited about him. It took him a little while to sort of bed himself in. He had a real drop off in form around Christmas as well and picked up an injury. But, like I said, with the introduction of Manetti being able to have a lot more energy and running around him, Jorgen Strandlarsen's been able to sort of lighten his workload a little bit and focus on being in the right place at the right time, which is what he's done more often than not over the last few weeks. So he's an exciting player, really struggled to replace Jimenez when he'd gone a few years ago, but I think Strandlarsen's the man now. And again, I mean, looking at records, Jimenez in his debut season for Wolves got 13 goals, and Jorgen Strand Larsen's already hit that with no penalties as well. So, yeah, really hoping he's got a bright future at Wolves.
Yeah. Where are you weakest at the moment? Because I'm conscious that that sort of question is something that, you know, when you take the season as a whole, you might be able to kind of look at various different parts. But while you're in good form like this, is there anything that you're worried about in terms of the setup right now?
Yeah, I know it's hard. I mean, because like I say, I mean, we haven't lost in 7 games, so it's hard to pick out sort of faults and weaknesses, to be honest. At the start of the season, and probably up until Vitor joined, that set pieces was a real issue of ours. I mean, City scored a late goal from the corner, didn't they, at Molineux? And around then, it was just awful run of form. And I can't remember the numbers, but I think Gary O'Neill had, in his time, had conceded 17 or 18 set pieces, and it was like 6 or 7 more than any other team in the Premier League at the time. It was an awful record. So we've really strengthened in that department as well, to be honest. I think where City are probably going to get their joy is if they allow Wolves to have the ball, Wolves, the defensive line does like to creep up and up and up. And we do play quite a high defensive line. At Old Trafford, we did it and got caught out a couple of times. Thankfully, you know, United didn't convert their chances. So I think if City are going to have the joy, it's probably going to be trying to catch Wolves out on the counter. However, saying that, away at the Etihad, I have no doubt we'll see probably a more of a low block from Wolves than what we usually see. So that might sort of cut that out. But yeah, other than that, we seem to be coping pretty well at the moment. It's very, very hard to pick out faults because everything that we were quite bad at under Gary O'Neill, we seem to have sorted under Vitor Pereira.
Yeah. Just looking ahead to next season, obviously there's a few games left of this one, 4 games left for both City and Wolves. What are you hoping to see now from next season? Because I remember speaking to you at the start of this year and kind of you feeling a little bit downbeat about how things are going and where things might go. You've put such distance between yourself and the relegation zone in the last few weeks. I kind of wonder how optimistic you can be for next season. Just like, where do you dare to dream for it to go?
Well, I think you look at the teams that are in around sort of the European spots at the moment, and there's no reason why, I don't want to sound too delusional, but there's no reason why Wolves can't be there next season. I mean, we've had European football just a few years ago under Nuno. You know, we've got the sort of potential, if we wanted, to really push for it. Recruitment and obviously changes in management have been far from ideal over the last few years. I think the recruitment that we've had has really held us back. However, I think over the last sort of 6 to 12 months, it's picked up a little bit. I think this summer's important for Wolves. They've really cocked it up over the last few years in terms of replacing players or bringing the right players in at the right time. I think we saved ourselves this year. We really didn't replace Max Kilman, and we had to wait till January and almost had to write off that first 6 months. As soon as we got a centre-back in, we've sorted ourselves out. So Wolves have just got to make sure they're proactive in the transfer market than being reactive almost. Cunha, I think, is bound to go. I think there might be one other big sale. Potentially Aitnori, I would say, is probably the favourite to move on. But from those two alone, you're probably making yourself close to £100 million in sales. You've got the likes of Fabio Silva still out on loan that you're going to make money off. So Wolves are going to have a little pot of money to deal with. It's how they sort of put that back into the squad. But we've never had, I say never, but over the last 3 or 4 seasons, I might be able to stretch back further than that, we've not had strong momentum to end a season. It's always ended really poorly. Under Gary O'Neill it did, Lopetegui, Large it did. So I'm hoping that for the first time in a long time, we can end the season on a high. I'm not expecting us to win the next 4 games and have a 10-match, you know, winning streak. That's not going to happen. But if we can still pick up another couple of wins between now and the end of the season and maybe have 1 or 2 losses in our last 12 or 13 games, for argument's sake, that'll be a really, really nice run of momentum to go into a new season. And yeah, hopefully we can build on that going into the campaign, because if you can have a squad of players that are happy, really, you know, happy to play, used to winning games going into a new season, it bodes well, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure. How does that fit with this Friday night then? What are you going for? We've got the charity bet coming up. How do you think the game will go? What's your score prediction?
I think it's going to be tough. And I think, you know, there are a lot of Wolves fans still very excited and think, you know, we can continue the run. But City, you know, you guys haven't been at your best, but under Pep, I think, and I still hope you win, you know, the FA Cup, and I think, you know, you should get top 4, but, you know, you still have something to play for, and I have no doubt Pep will want to be prioritising getting back into the, you know, to making sure you are still in the Champions League. So I think it's going to be a tough game.
It's the two form teams in the league.
Yeah. I'll be very, very brave here and say a 1-1 draw, I think. But, you know, City, Wolves are used to winning games now, obviously, with the six on the bounce. But City are a very strong team, especially away from home. You know, we picked up a couple of wins there, but it's still been a difficult place to go. So if I am very Wolves, you know, Wolves heavy, but I'll go with a 1-1 draw. But, you know, City do have the quality that they can hurt Wolves if needed.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Dave Azzopardi from Talking Wolves. Before we get to predictions, there's more news around this game because there are more protests planned for this one. Simon, there's been a lot said in recent weeks about tickets and City not selling out at Wembley and all this sort of stuff. What do you make of the continuing action that City fans are taking? This one is 6 minutes on the concourse to highlight 6 years of no new season tickets. And obviously it comes in the context of the club having announced a price freeze for next season. They have won some concessions from the club in this regard, but they're carrying on the pressure.
Yeah, it's a fractious situation. And it's hard because sort of there are a lot of legitimate viewpoints and a lot of kind of lived experiences, and you can't take people's experiences away from them. Mm. I think the fans have been encouraged, as they should be, by the fact that when they have overtly protested this season or overtly kind of kicked up noise, whether that be over season tickets or over like the plans to charge disabled fans for parking, they have forced the club to change their mind. And these are big decisions, that like impact the, to be sort of like blunt, what's in people's wallets every week. So I think, you know, they are within their rights to keep going and to try and keep the pressure on, because the North Stand is the big one. You know, the open letter to Pep this week talked about the decisions being made on North Stand will impact the stadium for years. So it's a huge thing that everyone wants to get right. You know, but there is loads to, there's loads to unpick from it, isn't there? And, you know, this is for 6 minutes. I mean, the club say that there were 1,200 new tickets in 2021 issued. So it's only actually 4 years since they issued new tickets. But there's not that transparency around tickets, and season ticket holders as a collective do not feel like they are being valued. Does that change after the season ticket price freeze? Possibly, but then the terms and conditions came out and you have to attend more games, and that generated a lot more anger. So I will be interested to see if the Wolves protest is as strong or stronger than the Leicester one because of those feelings, or if more people think, do you know what, I've got a price freeze for next season, I'm not as bothered.
Mm. Dan, the open letter was the big part of this as well this week. What do you make of that? And also there's been lots of social posts from City on things like photographs of fans where it says things like making memories and that sort of thing, and there's lots of replies and quotes of those posts about how it's actually not that accessible anymore.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I thought the open letter was excellent. I thought it was really well written, really got to the heart of the issue. I hope I'm not sure what the method of delivery for to get that to Pep is, whether he will actually read it. I really hope he does. And I hope that he, you know, he does have a word with Soriano about it, and it becomes a bigger topic of conversation within the club if it isn't already, you know, and actually gets to the level of the dressing room and the coaching staff, and they actually know about this and are aware of what's going on. And with the social posts, you know, I think sometimes there is a tendency to kind of misconstrue things like this. Oftentimes, it might just be, you know, someone in the social team has seen a nice photo of a dad and the kid or whatever and has posted it and not really thought about the sort of wider implications, the wider context of that. And it's a completely innocent thing. It's not like Ferran Soriano has gone, put that on social media, that'll really wind them up. But if it happens a second or third time, you kind of think there's a case of bad optics going on here, you know, you know, it's a little bit insensitive, and it's, you know, it's good to see people reacting emotionally to these things. And again, I hope it's a way that the message gets back to the club. And I hope, you know, sort of building on what Simon was saying, that the protest at the Wolves game is bigger than the one against Leicester, that more people do join in with it, because I think the season ticket price freeze is just the bare minimum the club could have done really here. And I don't think it answers all the topics. I think the fact that there's been a lack of dialogue with the fan groups over it has been really poor. I'd like to see people, you know, sticking it to them again this weekend, really. And, you know, I would encourage people who didn't participate in it last time to participate in it this time, even if maybe it doesn't affect you personally, if it's not part of your sort of personal circumstances. You know, I think it's something that everybody needs to kind of get behind and support, you know, as a fan base here. And I was having a bit of a chat with my dad about it after the first one against Leicester the other week, and he was saying, you know, perhaps a more effective way of protesting would be to, like, boycott food and drink at the stadium, you know, really sort of hit the club where it hurts. And I sort of appreciate that, and I'm inclined to agree with him. But I think, you know, people go to the match, and part of their match day routine is having a pint or having a pie, you know, especially on a Friday after work or school or whatever. You go there, you need a bit of sustenance, don't you? You know, this is just part of what people go to the game for. You know, it's part of the experience, and people shouldn't have to, you know, not do things that they're used to, that they enjoy doing. But the opposite side of that is that the club needs our support. You know, they need a vociferous stadium who's going to roar the team on right from the first whistle. And if we kind of deny them that, then that's the best message that could be sent, in my opinion, really. So
The best thing that happened with that Leicester game is that City scored while the protest was happening.
Yeah,
yeah.
I hope there isn't any more need for these protests going forward, but I think it is an effective way of protesting, basically.
From a sort of, you know, boring media take, but like the best things to do if you want headlines are visual. And, you know, I'm sure the MEN would cover people who chose not to eat food and drink at the stadium. But, like, everyone in that press box will cover the fact that there's thousands of empty seats behind the goal for the first 10 minutes, because everyone can see it and you can't ignore it. So, you know, I think what has been pleasing for me this season is that there's been more sort of consensus and sort of direction from City fans as a whole, because for a while there've been lots of kind of splinter groups who've all got different agendas and objectives and views, and you know, not everyone has exactly the same views, but there has been kind of a coming together from fans to say, you know, we need to do something about this and we need to work together. And I would also broaden that out, if you ignore kind of social media idiots, to like across the division with other clubs, where people are actually saying, you know what, our teams might be rivals, but we're all going to suffer the same consequences if we just sort of sneer and laugh and point at what's going on at Liverpool or United or Spurs. So it's been really encouraging for me to see sort of that collective working together.
Yeah. Right, well, let's see if we can raise some money for this Wolves game. The FA Cup's been a source of correct predictions this season. Phil McNulty was correct on the last show, saying it would finish 2-0 to City at Wembley. So that's taken our total for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group to £1,365 for this season. And that also makes this season our best ever on the charity bet. So well done, everybody. Dan, you won in the last round of the FA Cup. Let's see if we can't get you a winner on the Premier League this time. William Hill's given us three £10 correct score singles to try and raise as much as we can. We've heard Dave has gone for a 1-1 draw on Friday night. That's 8-1 and £80 if he's right. Dan, what are you having?
I'll go for a 2-0 City win.
That is 13-2 and £65 if you're right. Simon, over to you.
3-1 to City.
3-1 City is 9-1 and £90 if you're right. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on how to responsibly gamble, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now, Simon, for your first appearance of the season, I'm going to let you pick the Higgy jingle. 1, 2, or 3?
Oof, I will go for 3.
Number 3.
Have you got a theory on City that needs closer inspection, or just something to ask us? Because this is your section. Read something odd into Pep's tone or inflection, or a novel idea to improve team selection. Sick of these jingles? Well, give it a mention, or maybe something worthwhile to bring to our attention. Let us know, Blues, because it's your listeners' questions. Oh, yes, it really is.
It really is indeed. Get in touch on Blue Sky at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email contact at bluemoonpodcast.com as well. One question this week, it comes from Danny on the emails. He says, you have to say that any team that wins the league deserves to win it, and credit to Liverpool for being the best team by a distance this season. But do you find the coverage of their title win has been perhaps a bit over the top, more than City have been given for their achievements under Pep? This Liverpool team have won the league four games early and with a points total in the low 80s so far, and have had very little competition all season. It's pretty ordinary compared to recent levels, while City fans are told their titles were boring because it was all too inevitable. Dan, what do you make of it?
So, I had a feeling going into the season that English football needed a new Premier League champion. We didn't need that. We definitely wanted to win it again, of course. But just for the kind of the narrative, the media, the way that fans talk about the game, the way that the kind of our dominance was becoming too dominant in a way for the sort of wider picture. So in a very, very small way, I'm kind of glad that City didn't win it this year because it sort of changes the conversation a little bit. I've no doubt if we win it next year, it will go back to being that conversation again. And there was someone sent me a post from social media this week. I can't remember who did it, but it was like something like, since 2018, if your name isn't Liverpool or Manchester City, you've not won the league title. And one of my mates was like, hang on, we've won more of them than they have. They've only won two in that time. You know, sort of making the point that it's almost like lumping Liverpool win with our era of dominance. So I think, you know, we have had this dominance, and I think, you know, what has been kind of nice about the season as well is that we haven't had the usual nonsense about, oh, it's boring, it's inevitable, all this crap. You know, people just go very quiet all of a sudden when City fall off and have the season like we have done, and, you know, all that, the way that we sort of made it look easy in recent years, people just stopped talking about it overnight almost. And it's been, you know, a very boring season at the top of the table as far as I'm concerned. You know, in terms of the title race anyway, the race of the top four has been quite interesting.
It's funny. The Jeopardy follows City around. Where's the Jeopardy this season? It's in the Champions League race. Where is City?
Yeah. I've even been having a laugh with my mate who's a Liverpool fan about it, because he's been sort of acting all nervous all the past few weeks, you know, and he's like crying when they won the league the other day. And I was like, what's this like manufactured Jeopardy that you're trying to do here? Like, you know, just admit it, you miss City and you wish you were sort of compete with us, and it feels a bit hollow if you sort of just had a procession to the title this year. So, yeah, you have to be careful about being too salty about these things, I think. You know, Liverpool have deserved to win it this year. They've been the best team. I don't think it's been a hugely top quality league, but, you know, we've won a couple like that where the league hasn't been particularly top quality either. And you also have to be careful with, like, confirmation bias, I think, that just because you aren't seeing a lot of this talk about the league being boring, that it's not happening somewhere, that people aren't saying it somewhere. It's just a lot quieter when City haven't won the league, it seems, isn't it?
Yeah, I had a look at the numbers, Simon, since Guardiola arrived. The early title wins, so the titles that have not gone to the final day. 2017, won by Chelsea. 2018, won by City. 2020, won by Liverpool. 2021, won by City. And 2025, won by Liverpool. There's more non-City early title wins than City title wins. And every single one that's gone to the last day has involved City. So there you go, there's the Jeopardy.
Yeah, there it is, yeah. I think Liverpool, you know, I know the post talks about them being in the low 80s for a points total, but they have got four games to go. I would view any team that gets 90 points as outstanding. And if they get 90 points, I will call them outstanding. I also don't know if this view is shared, but Liverpool feel nicer with Arne Slot rather than Jurgen Klopp. It's a bit like PSG without Mbappe. You kind of like, you don't mind Liverpool's success as much because Slot seems like such a nice guy, and he doesn't come with like the baggage that Klopp had and the tendency to sort of bring up the charges at every opportunity and sort of play these, get involved where he didn't need to with the City rivalry kind of thing. I'm not sure that Liverpool will win the league next year. I think they are there to being challenged, and I think we've kind of seen it's been much more difficult for them in the second half of the season than it has the first. So maybe teams are working out ways to play them. But they've won the league since like December or January, and it's really, really hard. You know, like how City's 100 point season, so difficult because from December, January, they had no one to go up against. to have that quality to keep fighting and keep getting points is so difficult. So I kind of think hats off to Liverpool. And it's a big story because it's the first non-COVID title of the Premier League era. So the first time we get to see all these celebrations. And I also thought fantastic with the fella who managed to get blue flares into Anfield. Like a real Scouse touch that.
Yeah, excellent work. It's almost Bertie-ing, but I don't really know where on the scale it would fall because it's not City United. It doesn't make any sense, but I know what I mean. That's it for today's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one. Dan Burke.
Thanks for having me.
And Simon Bakowski.
Thank you very much.
There is a clip coming up of this week's Nostalgia Show very shortly. That was Adam Monk inducting Mario Balotelli into our Cult Hero Hall of Fame. If you want to hear the full thing, it's available now from patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. I'll be back next week after the game with Wolves, so I'll see you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can, and don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
They've just beat Arsenal 8-2, United. People forget this. Like, they were flying. You know, Ashley Young, Rooney were playing really well. So, like, I was going into that game. I remember I was in a Butlins with my mate at the time. He was a United fan. The bar was all full of United fans. And I was nervous. I wasn't expecting to win at all. And, you know, even when Balotelli scored that first goal, it was still pretty even keel. It was really when Evans got sent off that the momentum swing happened. And of course, Balotelli made that happen. So, yeah, but to go back to that first goal, like, you know, I've played football, you play football. Like, when a ball comes across you like that, to hit it with the inside of your foot, with no bat lift, like he didn't run onto it, he was stood still. And to have it sort of, it was like a daisy cutter. It zipped
so clean,
the
wasn't
glass.
It? Yeah.
Yeah. Zip, just like knuckleball low, so like just zipped. And it was put in the one place where De Gea couldn't get to it. It was a really, really amazing finish. Then, of course, the celebration being pre-planned as well. Like, who thinks to do that on such a big occasion? And also, like, the night before, like, as well, like, shouldn't you be just getting rest and stuff before a Manchester derby? But no, he's got a Catherine wheel in his shower. Like, it's just ridiculous.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.